episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, where history proves that truth, or at least their version of it, is truly stranger than fiction. In the many podcasts that we have done, we go through different histories that are in some way, shape, or form related either backwards in time to William Branham or forwards in time to William Branham. And William Branham is basically the linchpin for most of the research that you find on this website, although there are some background histories that we get into. But seldom do we give episodes that connect all of the dots. And it's always interesting to me whenever I'm watching the comment feeds of one of the podcasts, I find somebody who has actually connected the dots between two different, completely different sets of research. And honestly, out of everything that I do, that's the most exciting, is watching somebody light up and say, oh, I get it, I connect those dots. But there are people who listen and either they haven't heard the other podcasts, or they just really aren't, they don't have enough background information to connect all of those dots. And one of the things that I want to start doing as we go forward is to present a podcast that will help people to connect some of these dots. And if you're a person who is connecting the dots, maybe we'll give another spin on it that you maybe didn't think of. Or if you find something that I didn't, put it in the comment feeds and let me think of the thing that you thought of and I didn't. Because as we collaborate and we work together to unravel this history that has been so tangled in a spider web of deceit, the more eyes on it, the more perspectives we get, obviously the more information we will get. One of the stranger sets of research that I have engaged in is this latter reign to Colonia Dignidad. To anybody who's unfamiliar with Colonia Dignidad, it is a crazy, fascinating milestone in history for the healing revivals. A person who is sympathetic to William Branham and the message cult was from Nazi Germany and set up a compound in Chile. And I can't say too much because the things that happened there were atrocious. But if you go to Wikipedia or some of the various online sources, you can even find it on the History Channel. You can find just how evil this compound was, and the leader of it, Paul Schaefer, just how villainous he was. In our podcast, Revival History Series, we did an episode interviewing Carlos Basso, who is a researcher, one of the foremost researchers for Colonia Dignidad, out of a university in Chile. And he started talking about things that just blew my mind away. He was talking about James Bond-style gadgets that they had, the like in The Man with the Golden Gun, the golden pencil and all of this stuff. He said in the colony they had things like this, and they had these meeting places that were up on top of a cliff where you could only get to by helicopter. It's just a really fascinating history. But I watched in the comment feeds, people are talking, well, what does this have to do with the healing revival? What does this have to do with the things that we see today in the church? And they don't realize that that is a milestone of history that links back. So today in this episode, I'm going to try to connect some of these dots. There will be histories that I'll talk to that you've probably heard before, because that's what I'm doing, is connecting dots of things that I've said before. But for this particular episode, I want to string it together through the use of Paul Kane of the Kansas City Prophets, Kansas City Fellowship, International House of Prayer in Kansas City, Branhamism, etc. Paul Kane is very important because he gave later prophetic networks a living human link to the older revival history. And I know that there are others that do this, but Kane is significant not only because of his work with the Kansas City Fellowship, but because he was one of the people that you could tie directly to the leadership of the movement and key figures of milestones of history in the Christian charismatic movements throughout time, from the latter rain healing revival through the Jesus movement, Jesus people, all the way into the 80s, all the way literally until he died. He was such an important figure. Paul Kane was involved in the healing revival. He was one of the people who started to participate as a name nobody had heard. He did get connected to Branham, and the timeline of that is a little bit interesting. I want to get into some of that research and tie the dots together, connect the dots there for you. But after working with Branham and starting to get established, he becomes a transmission point for the prophetic celebrity networks that began to emerge. And because of this, his work with the Kansas City Fellowship was fundamental in molding and shaping what would become the New Apostolic Reformation. It was his work with the Kansas City Fellowship, the Kansas City Prophets, that he got connected to John Wimber and the Vineyard Platform. And through the work with John Wimber, the rest was really history. It began to explode into the charismatic movement. The worship style began to change. What you see in the New Apostolic Reformation really would have never happened without Paul Kane to be the backbone to this. And then when that developed into IHOP KC, International House of Prayer in Kansas City, now he is connected to all of the big names in the New Apostolic Reformation in ways that go far beyond just the prophetic. So he helped to establish some of the networks that we see, either directly or indirectly, I think in most cases indirectly, but Paul Kane was very significant. There are a couple other names that I'll mention because in the trail of history for Paul Kane, and as it relates to William Branham, these are significant figures, the first of which I'll mention is Minor Argenbright. Often when we talk about the Full Gospel Businessmen's Fellowship International, we talk about Demas Shakarian because of all of the interesting facts surrounding Shakarian and his connection to the Kardashian family, but not often do we talk about Minor Argenbright. Whenever the Full Gospel Businessmen's Fellowship was founded, there was a co-founder named Minor Argenbright. And if you have a background in the Branham religion, and you remember William Branham condemning all of these ministers and evangelists who drive Cadillacs because he could never do it, he could never take the people's money and purchase a Cadillac, Minor Argenbright is the person who gave William Branham his first Cadillac, which is another interesting side story. But needless to say, he was connected to William Branham, and the connection appears to be much earlier than people realize. Argenbright was born in Harrison County, Indiana, which is about 30 minutes drive from the Branham Tabernacle in Jeffersonville, Indiana. And according to people who have escaped the William Branham message cult of personality, Argenbright's family still has ties to the Branhamites today, as did Argenbright throughout his life. Now, he migrated to Los Angeles, California, and the timeline, it's a little bit sketchy. We can't really piece it together fully yet, but it's interesting that he's out there about the same time Roy Davis is out there and has these connections back to this area, which leads you to ask the question, were there more connections? Did the connections go beyond Branham to Davis? And for anybody who's followed the Davis research, that is significant because Roy Davis was quite popular among all of the fundamentalists. So there's a lot of history here to unravel, but Minor Argenbright, as it relates to Paul Kane, is key because of this one fact. Argenbright, William Branham, and the Full Gospel Businessmen helped to popularize Paul Kane's ministry in the mid-1950s, which is about the time that Paul Kane became a big name in the revivals. There's an article in Full Gospel Men's Voice, the publication of the Full Gospel Businessmen, talking about the deliverance of Paul Kane. And there's a few key things that you have to really pay attention to in this article. Number one, like William Branham, Paul Kane claimed that he was visited by an angel of the Lord. And in these publications, they always capitalize angel of the Lord. And just like William Branham, this angel came whenever Paul was very young and allegedly told him that he was going to be this great faith healer. You can read the story. I skipped through most of that and just pay attention to the details, because in the details, you'll find how to unravel all of these ministries. But again, like William Branham, there's this great commission by God. He is using the angel as part of, I guess, his stage persona prop. But here's where it gets interesting. If you go to page 5 of the article, it starts talking about how Paul Kane was suddenly sick and there was a death sentence that was looming over Paul Kane, which begs the question, could the healer not heal himself? That's, I'm certain, the question that everybody asked. Number two, he goes directly to William Branham. He phoned William Branham. So that shows the close connection that he had to William Branham in Jeffersonville, Indiana. And it says, for 2 long, agonizing months, he, Paul Kane, drew nearer and nearer to death. In one final desperate plea, he phoned William Branham at Jeffersonville, Indiana, to see if he could use his, being William Branham's, his supernatural gift of healing in an emergency. But William Branham's gift operates by instructions from the angel of the Lord, not by his will nor the people's requests, so he could not offer much encouragement to Paul. Now this, for me, is really interesting. Growing up, we heard story after story after story how people came and approached William Branham for their healing of their bodies. And there was never an instance in any of these tales where they said, William Branham turned us away because the angel of the Lord could not operate like this. That's not something that was done in these healing revivals, I can assure you this. But it is printed in here, which tells you that this was spinning off into a bigger tale than what was usually done in the Branham campaigns. And you've got this weird conflict. So you have the angel of the Lord who's allegedly working with Paul Kane, and that must be a different angel of the Lord that works with William Branham, because Paul Kane's angel couldn't heal him. He goes to William Branham, who's operating through an angel, to see if Branham's angel can heal him. So you've got these two competing angels, one of which is lesser powerful than the other one, which is really weird. But if you continue, it says, at the same time, Full Gospel Businessmen's Vice President Minor Argenbright of La Crescenta, California, phoned William Branham in Indiana and learned that Paul Kane's condition without God's intercession was hopeless. So here you have Paul Kane connected to William Branham directly and by phone. You have Minor Argenbright connected to William Branham directly by phone. Both of them calling over the same event, the same situation, Paul Kane's alleged need for healing. And nobody's asking the question, why can your angel heal and his can't? And worse, how come Paul Kane's angel can work and operate directly upon request and yours can't, William Branham? You're the leader of this revival, right? So this gets really, really interesting. It caused me to dig deeper into Paul Kane and his connection to William Branham. One of the most interesting aspects of this whole thing is the timeline and the inner circle of Branham, because as we've mentioned a few times before, and I'll throw it here on the screen, we have a letter from Joseph Matson Bose, who is introducing Jim Jones to William Branham. Matson Bose, who was I guess you would call his function basically an advertiser, but there was a period of time in which he was trying to rebuild William Branham's career after the Voice of Healing started to snub him. It just happened to be the mid-1950s, the same time that he's getting connected to Paul Kane, which is really odd when you think about it. Now, Joseph Matson Bose, he writes a letter. It says, Dear Brother Jones, talking about Jim Jones of People's Temple, Jonestown Massacre. And it says, basically, here's William Branham's phone number. You can call him at this number. You can write him at this mailing address. Always mark it personal. In other words, you won't get through to him unless you mark it personal. And there's some names in here. Reverend A.W. Rasmussen. He was the head of the Independent Assemblies of God. Another interesting name that you'll find in this letter is Claire Hutchins of Marantha Temple. This is the same Claire Hutchins that is of the Brooklyn Tabernacle, the famous Brooklyn Tabernacle Choir. All of these people are in William Branham's inner circle. Brooklyn Tabernacle Choir guy, Claire Hutchins, Joseph Matson Bose, Paul Kane, and the FGBMI magazine basically was telling the world, Paul Kane has just now had an instance of deliverance, and he is fit to go on the road again with his angel of the Lord. So when I began to dig into Paul Kane and his connection to William Branham, I found that he was actually connected to Branham earlier than this in 1951, and something very strange stood out. The very first time that he is mentioned in a revival, William Branham says, "I don't know him, but he's a brother. What's his name?" And somebody says, "Paul Kane." Now, that's not so problematic. You can forget a name, but the name Kane is pretty hard to forget. If you read the book of Genesis, it is one of the key figures in the book of Genesis. Although, if you consider William Branham's serpent seed doctrine and his doctrine that Satan was the designer of women from the creation, maybe he didn't read the book of Genesis. I don't know. But if you go to the next day in the same series of meetings, he says, "I understand that there's a brother King here." And somebody corrects him and says, "No, that's Paul Kane." So day two, he's already forgotten the name again. Day three, at this point, you're asking yourself, did he really forget? Is this part of the stage act? He says, "Brother King, Reverend Mr. King." And somebody corrects him and says, "Brother Kane." And by the next night, the fourth night, he says, "If I'm not mistaken, Paul Kane is going to continue the revival on." Fast forward a few years, and that same trick happens again. He starts talking this is in April of 1956. This is the point in time in which he's already working with Jim Jones, and he says, I don't remember his name. What's his name?" And somebody says, "Paul Kane." He says, "Oh, Brother Kane." So you can see that there's something a little bit odd about all of this. Yes, people can forget. Yes, I'm terrible with names myself. But the name Kane is pretty hard to forget. Even for me, I would struggle more to forget than I would struggling to remember that. So a little bit odd, but nevertheless, he is connected. And this is a time when William Branham is rebuilding, repurposing his campaign team. And he's trying to separate and distance himself from Gordon Lindsay because of a spat that was happening between all of them over William Branham's serpent seed doctrine, which is another key part of this timeline. It is about this time that William Branham is starting to show his roots back to Roy Davis and the very racist ideology that he was trained with, and there were ministers rising up against him about the time that he starts working with Jim Jones. And there's a series of death prophecies against William Branham in the mid-50s, which is something we'll get into probably in another podcast. But this is all about the time that all of this is coming together. It is during this time, after he connects with Kane and connects with Jim Jones, that he starts to become very open about his belief in pushing the serpent seed doctrine, the idea that Satan mated with Eve to produce Cain, the name Cain, and all of the evil lineage throughout time came through Cain's bloodline. That was William Branham's theology. So all of this is coming together, and again, we're focusing on Paul Kane, but look at all of the many connections. When you consider the Full Gospel Businessmen's Fellowship, fast forward to the 80s when the charismatic movement is taking off, this is one of the most invasive charismatic organizations that existed. They were basically funding all of the big ministries. People like, what's a good example? John Osteen, Joel Osteen's father. His whole ministry would have just collapsed had it not been for the Full Gospel Businessmen. The Full Gospel Businessmen apparently paid for his tent, sponsored his meetings, and launched his career into fame. And he would later connect with William Branham again in Houston, Texas, in another event we'll talk about later. But it's really odd when you see how all of these connections, they all seem to go back to William Branham. And then they separate, and then they come again back to William Branham. Now, if you read these articles, and you're reading it from the mindset of somebody who really believes, you're a believer in this movement, you read it and you think, oh my gosh, this is wonderful. The angel of God came down to Paul Kane. And if you read it critically, you're wondering, well, why do we need two angels of God around this healing revival movement? But I'm certain that there were people who believed it fully, and they said, I wonder which angel is better. Should we go to Paul Kane's angel, or should we go to William Branham's angel? I just don't know which angel is better. Well, this article kind of seals the deal. William Branham's angel is powerless whenever you think about this person has something that we need healed now. Can you heal us, O angel of God? So there are some logic flaws, the biggest of which is, like all of these documents that are in these magazines, There is no medical documentation. Whenever they claim tuberculosis or cancer or breast cancer, all of these different things, they really never tell you how they establish that. And as we have shown in some of the previous podcasts, often the establishment of those claims were simply the healer detected it before the medical industry even knew that this was a problem. And when the lady or the, I think it was a lady in the last example we gave, whenever the lady goes to the doctor, it's gone 100%. She is healed, praise God. But it was never diagnosed. That's one of the problems with it. The other thing is that there were some contradictory claims. Paul Kane, and I don't know if anybody's really thought about this, Paul Kane often told the story about how the mother and the baby, his mother, were certain to die. It really never explains how all of that came to be. If you think about how that would have been established, the mother's sick, well, how do they know the baby's about to die? And then when the baby's born, he was born healthy. So was he really sick, or did somebody just say that he was sick in the womb? We don't know. So there's a little bit of improbable things that could play out there. But think about the more improbable is the stacking of medical issues. Advanced tuberculosis, breast cancer, cancer penetrating a lung, 3 cancerous tumors in the womb. Whenever you stack all of these fatal conditions, you're heightening the drama, but it also creates this credibility problem because, well, did they really have that? Did they also have that other thing? Oh my gosh, did they have the 3rd and 4th, 5th, however many things they give? These ministries back in the 50s, they liked to do that because the more fearful things that you could give the person who's quote-unquote healed, the more amazing and miraculous their healing was. It's not just one thing they were healed by. They were healed by all of these other things. And I don't know that anybody's really thought through that with Paul Kane. But for me, the biggest thing really is this angel, because this creates a huge problem. You've got competing angels of God, one who can heal upon request and one who can't. How do you come up with this stuff, man? But that's what they advertised, and that apparently worked because Paul Kane began advertising himself as a minister like William Branham not long after this. Now, I've mentioned this before in other podcasts, but it's worth bringing up again here. Right after a meeting with William Branham, Paul Kane's secretary gets caught as a bank bandit all throughout the Los Angeles area. So you also have to ask the question, well, did the angel really know what was going on? Was that angel having the insight and the foreknowledge to discern all of the sins and evils of this world whenever he's got a bank bandit as his personal secretary? Paul Kane's personal secretary was a bank bandit. So there's so many questions to ask. But in the end, really, it comes down to this for me. What we see here is the creation of a stage persona. He probably had a different stage persona before the second deliverance instance that we're talking about here. He was a quote-unquote divine healer, and he claimed that the angel of God visited him at his birth. Otherwise, he would have not have been a healer, according to that backstory. Well, that story didn't make him famous. And so we added a new backstory, and the new backstory is he's just been healed of deliverance, and his angel was not powerful enough to do it, so we contacted William Branham's angel. William Branham's angel said, no, I can't do this. You can't just ask me for a healing. And so instead, he goes through the deliverance ministries, and the ministries themselves, as this thing is coming to a second surge of the healing evangelists, the second surge has a deliverance ministry that did, in fact, heal Paul Kane. More powerful than the angels, and we are the ones to witness this supernatural power.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support.
Another name that I've mentioned from time to time on the podcast is a really interesting character. His name is the German Baron William T. Freire von Blomberg, who is one of William Branham's campaign managers and was on the director's board of the Fellowship Foundation. Fellowship Foundation, for anybody who is unfamiliar, it's one of the most politically and well-connected organizations that help secretly fund different ministries in the United States. And it's really odd. It's like a fraternal order for lobbying different policies in Washington, but the members have to share a vow of secrecy, which is, it leads to all kinds of weird questions, and there are some documentaries out there. The fellowship's former leader, Douglas Coe, I think was his name, was very close to the people in Bethel Church. In fact, you can find Chris Vallotton talking about how they went to the house of Doug Coe and what a great guy he was. Well, before Doug Coe, before Bethel, way back in time, you had William T. Freire von Blomberg and Paul Kane and William Branham and others who were working to try to establish different chapters of the Fellowship Foundation and the Full Gospel Businessmen's Fellowship worldwide. And there was a tour that William Branham talked about frequently where he toured through Europe. And that's what they were doing. They were establishing these two organizations. What's interesting is, if you look at the National Prayer Breakfast in Washington, it's followed very closely behind it with the Full Gospel Businessmen's Breakfast. So you had this, you had these two entities that are somewhat disconnected, all shrouded in secrecy, funding different organizations. You really don't know what all is being funded. But there was a German connection through William T. Freire von Blomberg. And I, whenever I had my phone call with Paul Kane, my series of phone calls with Paul Kane, I think in two of those three calls, he mentioned his trips to Germany. He said that when he went to Germany, it was usually because William Branham was not permitted to go back in. And so William Branham would call him up and say, "Hey, Brother Kane, would you go to Germany for me? I can't go there. I'm not allowed back into the country," which raises this whole array of questions. You know, why is he not allowed? But more to the point, why was Paul Kane the one that he chose? And with Freire von Blomberg involved, Freire von Blomberg was the adopted cousin of Werner von Blomberg, which was Hitler's Minister of Defense. You start asking all these questions that some of them lead into Nazi questions, especially when you read research like The Secrets of the SS, talking about the South American Reich, and they mention Colonia Dignidad, which I mentioned earlier. This was the place that, it was basically the landing place where the Third Reich Nazis would escape into South America, ending up in Argentina and other countries, but they would land at Colonia Dignidad, otherwise known as the colony. And when you read stuff like this, it really raises a lot of questions that can't be answered. Some of them have been answered through the work of Carlos Basso and others who have actually gone to Colonia Dignidad and dug through their document cache underneath the, in the labyrinth underneath the colony. But it raises for me the question, how much of it can be traced back to this Baron William T. Freire von Blomberg? And also, considering the timeline as it relates to this podcast, well, how much did Paul Kane know? And that's really the question that I wanted to answer in this podcast. Unfortunately, I don't know without resurrecting Paul Kane from the dead and asking him. I don't think that we'll ever know the depth of knowledge that he had. But what we do know is that through the Full Gospel Businessmen's Fellowship and working with this German Baron William T. Freire von Blomberg, we at least have some of the information that was actually published in the Full Gospel Businessmen's Voice. In fact, in an article, Full Gospel Businessmen Chapter Stirring Germany for God, you can read how vice president of the Full Gospel Businessman, Minor Argenbright, and the editor, Thomas Nickel, came over to help Germans establish a chapter of the Full Gospel Businessman. And that is happening in Karlsruhe, Germany, the epicenter for our focus whenever we were researching and studying Colonia Dignidad. Karlsruhe is where Ewald Frank is, and if you know the Colonia Dignidad history, Ewald Frank was the person who is believed to have been supplying the colony with different things that are of suspect agenda. I'll just say it like that and keep it G-rated for the YouTube feed and for the podcast. But if you want to research that, you can go to Colonia Dignidad History. Carlos Beso has written an excellent book. You can read it. It is unfortunately in Spanish. I had to translate it. But that history and that connection to the Germans and the insidious things that happened there can be traced right back to this moment that we're talking about in the Full Gospel Businessman's voice. And if you read, it says, again in July 1957, Dr. Guggenbull sponsored a meeting in Karlsruhe, as well as meetings in Louisiana, Zurich, Switzerland, at which times Brother Argenbright and Nickel came over to help him. The main evangelist was Tommy Hicks, a name that many people are familiar with Paul Kane and Raymond Ritchie assisting. So you've got Paul Kane, Raymond Ritchie, Tommy Hicks, the Full Gospel Businessman coming over. And if you read on through, it says, at the July meeting last year, and that's talking about the July 1957, 15 nations were represented by those attending. During this time, much interest in Full Gospel Businessmen developed, and the Karlsruhe chapter was established. So what we're talking about here, William Branham comes to Germany. He is coming under the leadership of the Baron William T. Freire von Blumberg, who is the adopted cousin of Hitler's Minister of Defense, Werner von Blumberg. They come and they start setting up the chapters for the Fellowship International, very similar to what we have for the National Prayer Breakfast. They're doing this in other nations. And then falling on its heels are the Full Gospel Businessmen setting up all of these things, which raises a lot of questions, some of which I won't go into because it wades out into conspiracy theory. But needless to say, we're talking about something that is very important when you connect all of these pieces of the puzzle together. And right in the center of it is Paul Kane and Minor Argenbright. So here's where it gets interesting. If you continue reading and you make it all the way to page 18, you've read through how the Full Gospel Businessman's voice is advertising that through all of these wonderful meetings, we've converted the Germans to God. And not just the people who were already Christians and good people, we're talking about all of the people who were some of the bad guys during the war. And it goes through talking about the different places that they visit, essentially setting up Karlsruhe, Germany as a hub that connects to all of these other European countries. And from there, it's I think they use the word beachhead. This is the beachhead where we will come, we will establish ourselves, and then we'll spread throughout Europe, which gets interesting if you think about Paul Kane's influence in Europe. And if you go down to page 18, there is a picture there, and it's describing Captain Fritz Schoffel, I may be pronouncing that incorrectly, center on horse, shown marching through France with Hitler's armed forces in June 1940. In the background, the ancient fortress and the Cathedral of Laon. 17 years later, Captain Schoffel, now a college professor and editor of a Full Gospel magazine, was chosen as president of the Full Gospel Businessmen's chapter in Karlsruhe, Germany. The former officer in Hitler's army is now an officer in the Army of Jesus Christ, the Prince of Peace. Now again, a conversion to Christ, doesn't matter your background, etc., except for the fact that there are some stipulations that should probably be made within leadership. If you have a background that might make you dangerous, well, I'm not certain that that's a good fit for a Christian leadership position. However, that is what they did. And as you can see with the case of Paul Schaefer, who
had some horrific things in his past and his background, especially with children, which I, again, I'll keep it G-rated for this episode. You can go to Wikipedia and you can read about all of the terrible, terrible things that were happening. Some of the people that they chose in this leadership position for this movement weren't authentic conversions to Christ. I'll just say it like that and keep it at that. They were people who had no conversion. They had no real experience. They had no change in their life. And so they continued on to not only do bad things, but they used the movement as the vehicle to do some of those bad things. And that's where, for me, this gets really problematic, because I'm weighing, on the one hand, here is a movement that is advertising itself as doing good, but they're choosing some of the wrong people, and some of those people are very bad, and they're setting up chapters and organizations to spread this throughout Europe and appointing people who were former Nazis to run that. And then, take it a step further, William Branham's not allowed back in there, so I can disconnect Branham from this entirely. At this point, he's not allowed back. He wants to go back, I think. He's sending Paul Kane. So Paul Kane is going to Germany. He's meeting with these people who are literally building an army for God out of the people who were Nazis. And all of that comes back into the United States under the auspices of the Joel's Army Manifested Sons of God theme. Well, what kind of army were they building? And that's really the question, because if you think about the timeline, the Joel's Army doctrines were emerging late 1940s, and after the 1940s, it spreads into the Latter Rain movement. Throughout the Latter Rain movement, Manifested Sons of God doesn't catch on until much later. It was kind of a, I don't know, it was almost taboo in the movement. There were some people that adopted it, some people that didn't. Paul Kane, William Branham apparently did, and then took it into Germany. And so what we have here is the spreading of the Manifested Sons of God agenda into Germany through people like Paul Kane. Again, that original meeting was 1955. So as we're thinking about all of this that's coming together, Paul Kane's getting involved with Branham, Jim Jones is getting involved with Branham, the Baron William T. Freire von Blumberg is getting involved with Branham, Foursquare Church is heavily advertising William Branham. They've been involved with Branham somewhat since Latter Rain began. So 1954, Madison Square Garden in Phoenix, Arizona, Paul Kane is advertised in the newspapers by Leroy Kopp of Calvary Temple, who's out of the Foursquare Church. This is another William Branham. And in this Madison Square Garden meeting, this is being sponsored by the Foursquare Church, sponsored specifically by Chuck Smith's Foursquare Church. And Paul Kane talks about this later on in life. He says that it was at this meeting where Chuck Smith sponsored him, and then after that, not during, but after that, he becomes one of his campaign managers. So piecing the timeline together, 1954, we're building up to all of this event that's about to explode worldwide. After this, Chuck Smith gets involved with Paul Kane. So when I look at this timeline, I'm seeing Chuck Smith, I'm seeing the Germans, I'm seeing the Fellowship International. All of this is exploding worldwide. And with that explosion is the beginning of what we see that evolves into the New Apostolic Reformation. If you read down into that advertisement where Paul Kane is being advertised as another Branham, where William Branham says, "Paul Kane, a young man, but a mighty man of God." Paul Kane is giving his personal testimony, and he says that there was an angel who came to stand at the bedside of his mother, and the angel told her to be of good cheer because she was going to live and he was going to live, and quote, "the fruit of her womb would be a male child that she would name Paul, and he would preach the gospel in the spirit of the Apostle Paul of the Bible." So it isn't just that we've got a person who's a minister, who's an evangelist, who would later become pseudo-apostle status. He was a prophet status in the NAR, but they're kind of equal if you think about how the prophets work. More than that, he's the spirit of Paul. That's what's being advertised here. So Chuck Smith comes into a meeting and is going to sponsor the meeting for a person who has the spirit of Paul. And Chuck Smith is going to join in the campaign team after this to a person who has the spirit of Paul. And so we see how all of this can come together to the New Apostolic Reformation. I have the spirit of such and such from the Bible, or so and so from the Bible. I'm coming in the spirit of Elijah, of David, of Paul, of whoever it is. That was the mindset of the people at that time, and that was what was being preached to the people in the crowds. So the crowds were being conditioned to believe that the person on the platform was not just human, but they were the spirit of one of the figures from the Bible. The other thing I want to point out, if you go through some of the other Full Gospel Businessmen's Voice issues and look at what Paul Kane was involved with as it related to FGBMI, you can see that the prosperity gospel takes shape a lot earlier than many people think. Most people, when they think of prosperity gospel, they go back to the 70s, 1980s. That's really whenever it began to explode into a movement that was recognized. But if you go back in time and you read through some of these magazines, you can see prosperity gospel is woven all throughout. In fact, there is this issue in Full Gospel Businessman's Voice, which is July 1958. The article is Pierce Brooks is God's New Partner Now. And it begins by saying, our fellowship had not been in existence very long when evangelist Paul Kane brought to Los Angeles chapter meeting a Methodist businessman from Dallas, Texas. And that man was named Dr. Pierce P. Brooks. If you read the article, it goes on to talk about how Brooks got involved, how his company began to flourish financially, and it's giving crazy big numbers whenever you read through this. If you do the calculation on inflation over the years, we're talking large sums of money. How once he became involved with this movement, he was seeing capital and surplus of $250,000. The assets had increased to $3 million. The stockholders were elated, it says. And it's talking about, because we got involved with this movement, we're starting to see a lot of money flowing through. There are numbers up to $10 million described in here because they got involved with this movement. So the prosperity gospel did exist. Paul Kane was apparently, I don't know if he was involved in preaching it, but he was connecting people to Full Gospel Businessmen. And the whole premise of it was that if you were a businessman, you join in, you're a businessman for God. And that started to evolve into, well, if I'm producing fruit, I'm investing, shouldn't I see a return in my investment? And that's kind of how this evolved. They were attracting businessmen by telling them, apparently, that if you get involved with this, like this man in this article, you're going to see your business flourish because you are giving us your money and you're collaborating to make this mighty move of God. So we see the early roots of the prosperity gospel woven throughout all of this. And Paul Kane, again, is right here in the center of attention. So to recap, there are so many connections that whenever people tell me, John, that's guilt by association. You can't just throw out names because they're connected to other names. Well, if you see how all of those connections work, it becomes more like a gearbox. You've got one gear that fits in with another gear and they start turning. Well, then another gear comes and they start turning. And if you pull any one of those gears out, the whole mechanism doesn't work. So in the beginning, we talked about Minor Argenbright, who is right here from, I literally live like 20, 30 minutes from where he was born. His family's from this area. They apparently attended the Branhamite churches. That puts Branham's influence directly into the Full Gospel Businessmen early from its inception. And we see that there is some weird connection because it is the Full Gospel Businessmen's founder, Dima Shakarian, and working with the Kardashian who sponsored Branham in his early ministry. We've talked about that in the history with Avok Hagopian, where Branham goes out to Palm Springs, and that's really how all of this thing ignited. Well, that is through the connection of people who are working together, collaborating. So you've got those gears in the cog, the Kardashian family, the Shakarian family, who are related to the Kardashian family, the Argenbright family, who are right here in the area. There are other connections, which I unfortunately didn't get time to get into, but this is all happening out in Los Angeles during the years in which William Branham's mentor Roy Davis is going out to Los Angeles to that area to start involving people in the third wave of the Klan. So you've got all of these weird connections. What do you do with this? For me, I just take the connections and I piece them in mentally in my category of some of these connections are good, some of these are bad, but they have a broad scattering of influence that is swaying a movement in one direction or another. For example, Chuck Smith, was he good? Was he bad? I don't know. But I see that this is all coming together at the same time where some very, very bad people were getting involved in this movement. As I mentioned, the Colonia Dignidad research, we're talking about what would eventually evolve into a what's called codename Operation Condor in South America, where you have torture chambers, gas chambers. You have so many things going on in that compound in Colonia Dignidad. I can't connect that directly to Paul Kane, but I can say he was at the epicenter with the Germans that created that element. And he was, quote unquote, converting them to Christ. They were using what he created apparently as a vehicle to start establishing some of this. So what I'm trying to say is it goes both ways. In some ways, I can't blame Paul Kane for anything to do with this, or William Branham to do with anything with this, but they established the network, and the network is what enabled all of this. It was the vehicle that created it. Here's the scary part that I'm driving to. That type of network, what I'm talking about here with the Germans, that was the same type of network that was being established in the United States and Canada. Those networks, they're called apostolic networks, they're all working in cohesion. Sometimes, like the businessman I mentioned, it described him as a Methodist. So this Methodist got involved, he's not even Pentecostal, but now he's part of the network. And so that network of all of those apostolic networks, that laid the foundation for what became the New Apostolic Reformation. So fast forward into the 1980s. Now, after all of these networks have been established, you've got the Fellowship Foundation, who are spreading and setting up all of these vast networks worldwide. You've got the Full Gospel Businessmen, who are following on their heels, setting up the same kind of thing in the same areas, which raises some questions. But all of this labyrinth of networks have been created. After that, Paul Kane comes to Kansas City. He starts working with Mike Bickle, Bob Jones, others to form the Kansas City Fellowship. And what this is essentially is a group of people who say that they have a direct channel to God. And if you join into their network, they're a level above the rest. So out of all of these networks that have been established, their apostolic networks, well, now they have a source to go to if they want their prophecies and their revelations to flow down through the networks. That's really what was being established. In other words, here is now, out of the kingdom has been established, here is now the castle. And in this castle are the figures who are going to be the Kansas City Fellowship. That connects to, as I mentioned, John Wimber, the Vineyard Movement. Vineyard, which was already connected to Chuck Smith, who was already connected back to Paul Kane. So you can see these cogs of these wheels spinning, these gears turning. All of this comes together, and this eventually lays the bedrock that would become the New Apostolic Reformation. So if you peel all of the layers down and you take it all the way back down to its root, what do you have? You have something that was advertised as being spiritual, advertised as being Christian, that's building empires globally that are claiming conversions, some of which, as you can tell from history, aren't really true conversions, but there's a lot of money flowing through it. It's this labyrinth of networks that money is flowing through, and you have to have people who are facilitating and organizing that flow of money, because that flow of money is what will eventually fund what is the New Apostolic Reformation. So hopefully this has made some sense of all of the different details that I've put out in some of the podcasts, trying to connect them together. There are more connections for this, and I'll eventually get into those as well. But this is just one avenue of connections that flow to the New Apostolic Reformation from William Branham, and in this case, it's through Paul Kane. So if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.